Welcome to the Aquarimax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 49, recorded February 14th, 2011.
Greetings all, and happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day!
For those of you who might celebrate such things.
Well, most people do, unless they're anti-Valentine's Day. There are some of those, but...
People all around the globe, probably not most people do, but... Maybe most people who listen to us are aware of the tradition of Valentine's Day.
Just tell somebody that you love them. Tell your fish that you love them.
There you go.
Get some kissing gouramis.
Yeah, I knew you were going to bring that up.
I know, that's because I told you that we should.
Okay. How about a bleeding heart tetra? Okay. That's enough.
So, tell us some fishy updates today.
Okay, well, I would like to mention that my rainbow fish fry, some of them are starting to get metallic blue scales, which is nice. It's so showing that they're maturing, and of course they're growing, and they're happy to be in a 55-gallon tank with their parents and swimming around. It's interesting, excuse me, to note that there are some wee fry that are growing up in that tank just without any help. I've just noticed they're not only appearing...
Rainbow fish? Rainbow fish fry?
More rainbow fish fry appearing in the tank. They're not only appearing, but they're also growing up. There's a couple of fry in there that are quite a bit bigger than they were when they first became free swimming, and they're, eating and everything. You can see them. They have little full bellies.
They managed to not get eaten by their parents.
There's enough infusoria in the tank or whatnot that the couple of them can survive on that, so that's kind of fun.
That's good. I think you wanted to tell us something about the brine shrimp, too. Yes?
Yes. Brine shrimp. Well, I was hatching some brine shrimp just for feeding to fish a while ago. I think I mentioned something about that. This is not the baking soda experiment. This was just normally doing it with the saltwater method. And I had some extras, but there weren't really enough that I could easily... use the light method and draw them over to the light and siphon them out and miss the eggs and whatnot. But there were a few in there, and I didn't want to waste them. So I thought, I bet my opayula would appreciate some newly hatched brine shrimp. So I tossed some in to one of my opayula tanks. Now, I probably should have thought, I might be interesting some in introducing some sort of bizarre bacterial culture to the opayula. I didn't think about that at the time. I just thought, they probably like to eat these. But I... tossed them in. And a few days later, I looked in there, and they were still in there, and they were growing, and there were all kinds of them. There were a lot more than I thought I had put in there.
We've got more brine shrimp than opayula now.
Oh, easily in that tank, yeah. There's probably a good 200 brine shrimp in there, and they're a week and a half or so old, and they're growing like crazy. I think it helps that they are, that the tank is cycled. There's a lot of surface area in that lava rock in there. I think that helps. And the tank does get some natural light, and I think there's some suspended algae growing in the water and so on. But one thing is that the salinity is very, very low. Opayula don't need very much salinity. I think there's probably about 2 teaspoons per gallon of water in there. It's not a whole lot.
2 teaspoons of salt.
2 teaspoons of sea salt per gallon of water. It's not a whole lot. Salinity is pretty low. It's lower than is generally used for hatching or keeping brine shrimp, but the brine shrimp are thriving in there. Interesting. I once read in an old book that if you had some leftover brine shrimp in salty water, you could dump it outside in a container with other water, and you didn't need to add extra salt, and you'd still do fine. And it makes me wonder, because brine shrimp are capable of producing 3 different types of eggs. They can produce... the resting eggs, which are thick-shelled and resistant to extremes of temperature and dryness and so on, they're the ones we purchase. They also can produce another type, which hatches very quickly and it has a thin shell and is not resistant to a lot of extremes. And then this may depend on the species, but some of them apparently give live birth in that these very thin-shelled eggs hatch before they come out, and so... they give birth to live young. And it could be, I'm just wondering, this is just pure speculation, but it may be that brine shrimp resting eggs can't hatch at the really low salinities. We do know that they tend not to hatch very well at low salinities, but what I speculate about is maybe these thin-shelled eggs or the live birth, maybe those can do better at low salinities, and maybe populations could be maintained that way. I don't know. It's just speculation. So I'm going to look into that. I'm going to experiment with that a little bit.
See how long they last.
See what happens, yeah. See if we can get multi-generational brine shrimp at these really low salinities. I mean, this may not be groundbreaking stuff, but it's interesting to see that this is a much lower salinity than most people recommend for hatching or rearing, and they're doing great so far. That's about it for that.
We do have a new video of the Celestial Pearl Danios up on YouTube, and I believe it's on our Facebook as well.
Yes, I did put a post on Facebook and on Twitter about it.
It's the Celestial Pearl Danios feeding on the microworms.
Yeah, and it's just about a minute long. I didn't put any dialogue on it this time. I put, YouTube has the option of putting a music track on that YouTube actually supplies, so you can do that. And I figured, maybe you're all tired of listening to my voice on the YouTube because you listen to it on the podcast already, and maybe you don't want to hear it anymore. I don't know. Or maybe you want to hear different music from just the Aquarimax soundtrack that I always play. So, hey, you want to try something different? So I tried that.
And let us know what you think. If you like it better with the narration, with the information, let us know that. If you like it, where you can just watch the fish in the music.
Or you'd like to see some of both, let us know.
We could make a narrated version and just a music, like the relaxation version. You can just put it on full screen on your computer and loop it, and it'll be like your screensaver.
There you go. And I really am interested in receiving some constructive criticism. Some people have had some good comments about the videos we've been doing, but any comments you want to put there, I do leave the comments field open in case you want to say something like, whoa, Russ and Kelly, this video really is not very good. Or, you want to say that? That's okay. Just let us know, and let us know why, what we can do to improve.
Or if you just really like it, you can tell us too.
Brian liked it.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian left a comment on the Facebook page, and he said that he liked it, or at least he liked the fish. I don't know about the video, but he liked the fish, and he asked what temperature range that CPDs do well at, and I did respond there, but I'll respond here for the benefit of all. High 60s to maybe low to mid 70s are good for breeding. You get any higher than that, and their breeding doesn't go so well, although they can survive higher temperatures, no problem, but they do like the lower temperatures for breeding. So I think right now I've got a heater in there, but in the spawning tank I generally don't put a heater at all. I think the grow-out tank is 74, and I just don't put a heater in the other one, and our house temperature gets pretty cool in the winter.
Yeah.
We're down in the low 60s high 60s to low 70s. Yeah, usually high 60s to low 70s in the winter.
70s tops that we usually get to in the house.
And they do fine, and they breed at those temperatures. So there you go.
So we have an email now to talk about from Russ in Wisconsin, although not our Russ, not this Russ.
I haven't been to Wisconsin.
No. Plus, you're not in the habit of sending yourself emails.
Well, not that you know about. Okay. Anyway, we have an email from Russ, and he had some interesting questions. He started out with a 20-gallon tank that he inherited from his son when his son went off to college. And then Russ's wife showed some interest in the tank and wanted a bluefish. And so, of course, Russ took the opportunity, as I would have, to go to the pet store and buy some blue fish. Pseudotrophius assay and Pseudotrophius lombardoi, which are both Rift Lake cichlids, which of course are also known as, I can't say that all Rift Lake cichlids are known as Mbuna, but these fish are known as Mbuna, and there are lots of Rift Lake cichlids that aren't Mbuna, so I don't want to confuse anybody, but anyway, those are lovely fish. They're both quite beautiful fish. The P. assay is fairly peaceful as an Mbuna, and the P. lombardoi not quite so much. It can be actually a pretty violent fish. And one problem with Lombardoi is that the females are blue and black, and the males are yellow, and that
Yellow? They're not yellow and black?
Well,
yellow?
They're kind of yellow with a sort of muted, darker pattern on them.
Okay.
Hard to explain exactly, but especially for someone who's partially colorblind like me, but...
Sorry.
I'm going with what I know here. I can see colors, just in case you're wondering why I look at brightly colored fish. I can see colors, but I see them differently from most people. Anyway, because the females and the males are reversed in the color, there are a lot of species of fish...
Reversed from what?
There are a lot of species of Mbuna where the male is blue and black and the females are yellow.
Oh, okay.
And so these fish can get really confused about which gender is what, and it can cause a lot of aggression.
Like if there's other fish in the tank, they will get confused.
Yeah, different species, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I would just say there's a warning for the future. That could be an issue. Especially those Lombardoi are just mean in a lot of cases. I mean, we had some. I don't know if you remember, but... we had some with our Mbuna years ago, and we had to take them back to the store because they started getting really mean, and they were small.
Taking some back, and they were really not very polite.
No,
fish.
And those were the ones, and they were very small, but they were still meaner than most of the other fish in the tank. Anyway, I think it's great that you went to get a larger tank because Russ went to get a 60-gallon when he realized that he was researching this idea about African cichlids. And found that they weren't going to do very well in that 20-gallon tank, which is true. I think one Mbuna could do fine in a 20-gallon tank by itself, of course, but not very long in a 20-gallon. And so the 60-gallon is a good idea. So what I would say is he says he's thinking about adding three female Lombardoi and another male and three more females for the assay. And he's not interested in breeding, but he is cycling the tank right now. I'm sort of messing up the order here of the email, but I think that's good. I'm wondering if you're cycling it fishlessly, which would be great. And, you know, there's other ways to do it, too, that could work just fine, but that's just my curiosity. It is nice when you're adding Mbuna to a larger tank to add them all at the same time for purposes of reducing aggression. Although...
So they don't already think this is mine, you can't put in another fish.
Right. Although, and try to keep the fish within approximately the same size range. I would probably try to add, this is me, some of you may disagree, but I would probably try to add at least 10 more fish total.
So how many fish would that be total in the 60 gallons?
Let's see, I think he's got two in there now, so that would be at least 12. And I might even do more. And I would consider possibly adding some more species, but being careful with the color issues that I was talking about before.
So no yellow and blue and black.
Like nothing male that's blue with black bars or yellow that resembles a male Lombardoi, but then if you add females that are blue and black barred, then you could get some hybrids, but you're not planning on breeding, so you'll probably get baby fish, but you're not going to... you know, be producing those or releasing them outside of your tank. You just, whatever survives in there, but whatever gets in the tank stays in the tank, so to speak.
Fish Vegas.
Yes. Don't, you know, as long as you're not bringing those fish, those hybrids back to a pet store or anything like that, then you should be okay. Or you know, distributing them among hobbyists or anything. But anyway, those are just a couple of points relating to that, but that's not really Russ's real question, so... Thanks for hanging on with me there, Russ. We'll get to your other question. His main thing, he just wants his fish to be healthy and in the best color and so on. He wants to know about his water quality because his water, according to his tests, he's got 20 parts per million of nitrate, zero nitrite. His GH is 25, chlorine zero. KH is 300 plus and pH is 8.0. And he's wondering if he has soft water out of the tap, do I need to add aquarium salt to my water changes? Should I use Epsom salt to raise the hardness of my water to a more suitable level? Well, I don't think at this point you need to add
any
more aquarium salt.
Wait, he's going to have to wait until after the break to find out!
After the break, okay.
This isn't a commercial because it's not trying to sell you anything.
It is, however, the part where we shamelessly encourage you to be a part of the Aquarimax audio show by calling and leaving a message any time of the day or night at 801-477-0629. If you don't want to actually talk, but you do have a comment or question, you can just send us an email to info@aquarimax.com. There. That wasn't so painful now, was it? Okay, now you can find out.
Okay, where was I? I was talking about... Okay.
Epsom salt.
Yeah, I don't think you need to add any more aquarium salt because, for those of you who don't know, most water softeners, basically, they are full of salt, and when you put your water in, they take ions of things like calcium and magnesium out of the water and replace them with sodium ions. So that changes the way that the water interacts with soap, for example, you know, but it does add those sodium ions to the water. So you probably have plenty of those in the water. You know, a lot of pet stores actually use water softener salt as a type of a tonic. You'll see in some stores, they'll get the little plastic clear cups and set maybe half a cup of water softener salt, the big pieces. Mm-hmm. They look like charcoal briquette shaped, except for smaller. And they're salt.
Are they black? Like
no, but they're that. They look like that, the same shape as okay. a charcoal briquette, but they're smaller. They're
like
about
a
the size of
biscuit shaped.
The last joint on my pinky or something, about like that big. Anyway, they'll put those in tanks and let them sit there and slowly dissolve as a sort of a general tonic and prophylactic. So, you know, it's not that bad for your fish in general. I mean, specifically, there are problems that it can cause definitely. Fish that are not salt tolerant can cause definite problems for many aquarium plants, but with fish that are very tolerant to hard water and so on, it's usually not a big problem. It also has some benefits. It can help reduce nitrite toxicity during a cycling tank. And it does help reduce osmotic stress on fish. So that's... I don't know if I need to explain osmotic stress. A lot of our listeners probably already know that.
Explain osmotic stress.
Okay. Well, basically...
Really fast.
The diffusion of water across membranes of the fish, you know... Water flows into a fish's body from the outside. They don't have to drink it. It just naturally flows. And they have to excrete a lot of urine to keep the balance because their body is saltier than the water surrounding them. This is freshwater fish. And so basically by putting more salt on the outside of the fish, the balance between them is closer. And so sometimes when a fish is under stress, having to flush all that water out of their system is a little bit stressful. So if you put some salt in the water, it can help reduce that. That's basically what that is.
Okay.
Most healthy aquariums don't need extra salt added to the system. If we're not talking brackish fish or saltwater fish, healthy system doesn't need that. But it can be useful in an Mbuna tank because it's a component in a mix of substances that can help approximate the waters in a rift lake. You can buy Rift Lake cichlid salt, and some people make their own with basically sodium chloride, Epsom salts, and baking soda. So
do we have a recipe?
Yeah, there's a link, and I'll put this on the resources page, but it's www.cichlid-forum.com/articles/buffer_recipe.php. Or you can do it like, you could do DIY... Rift Lake recipe, and I think that would show up.
Okay. And we'll put that on the resource
page. We'll put that on the resource page, but to give you the basics here, for every 5 gallons of water, you add a tablespoon of Epsom salt, a teaspoon of baking soda, and a teaspoon of marine salt. And you want to try to get... if you add the baking soda first, you can get a pH of between 8.2 and 8.6. And Russ, yours is around 8, so you could try adding some baking soda for that. And then... If your GH is already 25, as long as you trust your kit, if yours is a pretty good kit and you trust the results there, you may not need any Epsom salt because 25 is within a pretty good range for a lot of Mbunas. But if you already have some salt in your water, of course, I wouldn't bother with the marine salt. At least you see how the fish do without it, and I think they'll be fine. We could get into a really long discussion of GH and KH and all those things, but basically the idea behind baking soda is that it will raise KH without affecting the GH, usually. But if you want to buffer both GH and KH, you want to keep them fairly high, another possibility you can consider, if you don't have it already, is crushed coral substrate. That'll work on both GH and KH, and that could be a good way to do it. I would kind of lean toward that way myself, just because your softener probably took out the calcium and magnesium ions to a large extent, and that would be putting them back in, so it would help approximate the natural waters maybe more closely. The Epsom salt should help with magnesium ions, because it's magnesium sulfate, but you wouldn't be getting a lot of calcium there. But the crushed coral could really help. And the idea between a crushed coral, the idea behind crushed coral substrate is that you're going to have a lot of surface area if you have substrate made out of it. And you got a lot of water that's going to flow by it, and then so some of it will dissolve. You can't just like put a piece of, you know, one shell or a piece of limestone rock in the tank. There's not enough surface area, but with a crushed coral substrate, that's a lot of surface area, so you'll get that buffering. So, yeah, I would say start with the baking soda first and see what you get, and then maybe Epsom salts if you feel like the GH needs to go up a little bit, and then maybe crushed coral substrate if you just want to not worry about what you put in there, and you'd pretty much be covered, I think. And I hope I didn't go into too much detail this time. Russ was worried about that. I think he did fine, but maybe I went overboard. I don't know. Okay.
I think it was fine.
All right, well, let's listen to Andreka's email then. Or not
her
email, her
message.
Her voice message. Yep, let's listen to that.
Hi there. My name is Andreka, and I'm calling from Oregon. And I am a new fish tank freshwater fish owner. It's definitely somewhat costly. And I was wondering, what would you say is the average cost you would kind of map out for a beginner fish person, you know, the tank, the pump, and I'm talking about like things that work. We got a kit and the heater didn't seem to be really doing the job, you know, so like what would you recommend for new, completely ignorant people in terms of the heater, the pump, just all the gear, and what would you say is vaguely the realistic price one should expect? Also, what would you say are the unexpected challenges or downfalls of having a fish tank? For instance, ours got ick like the first week we had it, and so, you know, we've been doing the water changes, and also we noticed that sometimes the pump could get really loud, and that was an unexpected thing, that the fish tank could get kind of noisy. So, anyways, those are my questions, and thanks for your show. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Andreka, for calling in. We will attempt to find a satisfactory answer to those questions.
Yeah, well, one of the first things you mentioned was mapping out average cost for a beginner, things like the tank and the pump and so on. Well, this really depends on a lot of things. You mentioned you wanted things that work, so good quality equipment is important as well. And I would say it depends a lot. So I'm just going to give you some ballpark figures and hope that's good enough, because it's really hard to generalize to some extent. But I would say that, you know, a lot of beginners get a 10-gallon tank, safe to say. Not that that's necessarily the best thing. It's usually better to get a bigger one. If you start out with a 29, for example, you have more wiggle room. So I would say, I don't know what size of tank you have, but a beginner should start out with as big a tank as they can reasonably afford and fit, and so on. But let's say you start out with something small, and you're looking at a kit where you have everything that comes together. They do have some pretty nice kits that are, these days, the higher-end kits. The low-end kits, I wouldn't really recommend them a lot of times, because the equipment in them is often not the best, and they don't necessarily have everything you need. They're cheap, which is why people find them attractive. but they're not...
They're cheap for a reason.
Yeah, they're cheap for a reason. And so they're not necessarily the best option. Let's say if you're starting out with a 10-gallon, though, just for the sake of the argument, because most people do, or a lot of people do anyway. I don't have any statistics saying that most people do, but... I'd say for most kits, you could pay anywhere from $39 to $68, $70 a kit for fresh water. And that's not even... In the lower end of that, you're not even including the heater or decor. And in some stores, you can get, like, a deluxe kit where they include more things, and that's a different cost and so on. Because the tank itself, 10-gallon tank, might be somewhere around $10, $10, $12, just by itself, nothing else. And then the filter can be anywhere from about $15 to $30 for that size tank. And the heater from about $15 to $25 or $30. And then the hood or a cover glass with a strip light combination somewhere between $20 and $30 or even a little more. And gravel somewhere between $5 and $10. The decor, depending on where you're going with that, could be anything. I mean, you could spend $100 on decor for a 10-gallon tank if you really wanted to. Or you could be more around $20. And then... They all often have things like a little bit of food and dechlorinator, maybe a net, and that might be somewhere around $15. So sometimes you can get things for cheaper if you get a kit, but
Craigslist is good.
Well, see, that was something, I'm glad you mentioned that. I was thinking of mentioning that. Rather than getting a kit, I would do a little bit of research on Craigslist or other similar sites.
If you have like a local newspaper that does classified or...
Yeah, especially if they do internet classifieds and things like that. Mm-hmm. You can often get a really sweet deal that way.
That's how we got most of our tanks when we moved back from Hawaii. It was all of our tanks? Most of our tanks?
When we moved back from Hawaii, we got some of our tanks that way. Mm-hmm. Some of them John set us up with because we had given them to him when we left and he gave them back. But the ones that we bought, yeah, we just got that way. We actually had my parents who were here on the mainland... I asked them if they would do a little shopping around and find some tanks so that I could have a place to put my fish, and had them fishless cycle the tanks when I was gone.
Which we appreciated.
Several weeks before we got there, I had them fishless cycle. So that was helpful. But anyway, I would say that is probably a better way to get a tank. Then you can customize it, and you still didn't spend as much as you would have spent for a new, smaller tank. Of course, you have to make sure you get a good stand. If it doesn't come with a stand, that can be an issue too. But we didn't even talk about the stand as far as the price goes. It is costly. It does add up. And we're talking about fresh water here. If we go into salt water, it's a lot more. Because things like lighting and protein skimmers and so on, it all adds up. Refugia and so on. So, basically, with a 10-gallon tank, you could be spending $70 or more just to get all the things you need, including a stand. And you want to look into some good brands. I would say some of the best options if you want to go smaller than that are some of the complete systems like the one Marineland does. The Eclipse systems, they have an Eclipse system like a 3-gallon, a 6-gallon, a 12-gallon, and so on. Those are pretty nice systems. They have an integrated filter and light built in. Marineland's not paying me anything to say that. But they're a good thing to start out with if you want to go smaller than that. If you want to go bigger than that, you know, you can get really expensive. They have some really nice high-end setups that even just freshwater that for 20, 30 gallons could be $200 or more easily. I mean, could be quite a bit more than that. But hopefully that gives you an idea of what kinds of things to expect in terms of how much you're going to spend. One of my favorite heaters, because you did mention specifically the heater, is the Marineland Pro, or the Marineland Stealth. I have liked for a long time. They tend to be fairly dependable, and I like the fact that they're plastic, so they're shatterproof, and they turn off when they come out of water, and so on.
Do we do a?
They don't have those.
Heater?
I don't know that we've done that. I don't know if we've done that, but
maybe we should do one on heaters.
Maybe we should. But they have a new line out. It's the Pro Stealth, and that seems to work just as well. There were some scares with it earlier, but I think they've taken care of those problems that they may have had or allegedly had. And because I don't know, have no firsthand experience that they actually did have any problems necessarily, but heard rumors about it. Anyway, I like those. I have a Pro Stealth that I'm looking at. It's about 3 feet away from me, and it works nicely. I like the, like I said, the plastic factor, the fact that it's black, and so it blends into a black background very nicely.
Hence the stealth.
Yeah, the stealth factor there.
Your fish can all play that they're spies.
Yeah. I do like several types of hang-on-the-back filters. I like Aqua Clear. They're nice. They have a sponge that you can take out and rinse out and put it back instead of throwing it away every month or two.
Which, if she's new, we do have another podcast where Russ reviewed that quite thoroughly.
Yeah, I did talk about filters a bit. And Aqua Clear is nice. I think you're talking about Everclean Aqua, though. I'm not talking about that just now.
What'd you say?
I'm talking about Aqua Clear.
Everclean Aqua.
Yeah, that one's a more high-end filter. It's a little more expensive. But as far as hang-on-the-back filters go...
Never mind, don't listen to me.
Aqua Clear I like fairly well. And I do like the Marineland Bio Wheels quite a bit, too. They do have disposable filter cartridges in them that you can replace, but if you buy the same filter cartridges over and over again, that gets kind of expensive, but you can replace them with other media, and that's pretty good. But those start out, for a 10-gallon tank, you can get a small one for about $15, $16 online for the ones that fit a 10-gallon tank. So they're not too bad. Now, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about... pumps getting loud. I think there are several reasons.
That drives me nuts!
There are several reasons why pumps can get loud, okay? And I think when you say pump, you're meaning like a hang-on-the-back filter type of pump that has a water pump in it. It's not the same as an air pump, of course, and I think you're talking about water pump. I hope that's what you're talking about. But they can get loud. There are a couple of reasons why. One is that there's an impeller, which is... You know, it's kind of like a propeller. It's a little different, but it has little fins spinning around on an axle. And it sometimes doesn't get seated fully. There's a little cylindrical part to the impeller that needs to get seated in the motor part of the actual filter housing. If it's not seated perfectly in there, so it's pushed all the way down in, then it can wiggle. And when it wiggles, it makes noise. And that can be really annoying. So make sure that it's seated completely as far in as it's supposed to go. A lot of filters will still work if they're not all the way down, but they'll make a lot of noise. So make sure that that is not an issue. Another thing is that if the water level is too high, of course, the water is going to make a lot of noise. If the water level is all the way up to the top, though, of the tank, that can help. And then,
you mean if the water level is not high enough?
If the water level is not high enough, it can make a lot of noise. And then
it splashes.
Exactly, it's splashing, of course. And that one's more logical and more obvious, I guess, to notice, a little bit more intuitive. But another issue is that bubbles can get caught in the filter tube. And if they do, that can make a lot of noise. And that can take a day or two for the bubbles to work themselves out. So, also something to keep an eye on if you have the type of filter that has a transparent tube. You can look and see if there are bubbles struggling in there, and if they are, then you'll know that that's an issue, and you can try to free those bubbles by gently kind of moving the tube sometimes, and that can help it be quieter. So I know some of those sound kind of goofy, but those can often correct some of those problems that exist. Now, as far as unexpected challenges, and there's really a lot we could go into here, but just to talk about a couple of things. Of course, cycling is a pitfall or a downfall for new aquarists. A lot of times they'll get the fish, put them in the water, and not realize that they're releasing ammonia that is not visible in the water. It's not making the water look dirty. Doesn't cause any, you know, bad smells necessarily, at least not right away. And the fish look like they should be healthy. The water looks clean. The filter's pulling all the gunk out of the water that's visible. But all this ammonia is building up in the water and making the fish sick. It's interfering with their ability to breathe. And because it doesn't help them, it doesn't allow them to uptake oxygen as they should be able to, and so on. And that is a big one. So really, we don't have enough time to talk about cycling necessarily in this show, but That's a big issue, and so make sure that you understand the nitrogen cycle, also called the ammonia cycle. Make sure you understand that and recognize that that needs to be taken care of, needs to be understood as a factor. If you don't understand the nitrogen cycle in an aquarium, then as a newbie, you could be in serious trouble. So make sure you do. And then another one is quarantine. Now, if you've just bought two little, I don't know, zebra Daniels or something to start out with in the tank, two or three little zebra Daniels, and they come home with ick, and those are the only fish in the tank, maybe you don't need to worry about quarantine because they're the only fish in the tank. But basically, fish in stores are often under a lot of stress, and when you put them in a bag and bring them home and put them in a tank with different conditions, they're going to be in more stress. And if the tank has not yet cycled, they're going to be under even more stress. So that is likely to reduce their ability to regulate their immune systems, and something like ick is likely to happen. Now, there are some theories about ick, various ones, and one idea is that ick is always, basically the parasites are always at a low level in just about any aquarium, and once you suppress the immune function of the fish through stress, then it attacks. That may well be true. I don't know if that's true or not, but it seems that when fish are under stress, that ick will often show up. So it's good to have a quarantine tank. Whenever you're going to introduce new fish into a tank, you keep a tank cycled. Maybe keep a few shrimp in it or something, and so that the tank is always cycled, and keep a nice biological filter going in there. And when you're going to try to put new fish in your tank, put them in there for 2 or 3 weeks beforehand. So also read up on quarantine tanks and how to do that. But that's the basic idea. And then if anything's going to show up, you can treat it in that tank instead of introducing it to your other fish. I've noticed that one of the best treatments for ick is just to keep the temperature warmer than normal. Most times it's not good to keep fish too high of a temperature, because the higher the temperature gets, the lower the amount of dissolved oxygen that can exist in the water. But I've had times, if I have an ick outbreak for whatever reason, I'll turn the temperature up maybe to high 80s, maybe like 88 degrees, and leave it there for 10 days. And that generally interferes with ick's ability to function and can boost the fish's immune system, and that can help destroy ick. There are some fish that can't tolerate that, so I can't recommend that for every fish. But it will work for a lot of situations. It's worked a lot for me. But just be aware that ick is generally, the appearance of ick in your tank is generally, or at least often, a result of stress. So that's a basic idea. I feel like I haven't addressed everything, all of your questions completely, but hopefully I've given you sort of an overview.
Dedicate another podcast to more detail.
Yeah. So, Andrejka, we do thank you for your questions, and if you want some more specific information on those issues, please let us know. I want to make sure that I cover what you need to know about. So send us another email or send us another voice message if there's something else that you need clarified, or you'd like more detail on a particular item there, or several of them, because we'd really like to help you out. And if you have an emergency, you need a personal email, feel free to do that too, and we'll see what we can do to help you. Let's see. But we'd like to thank all of our contributors, Brian and Robert, who sent us a message on Facebook. He's glad that we have Facebook now, and so are we, and we're glad that Robert joined in. Thank you to Russ from Wisconsin for sending us a message about water quality and his mbunas, and to Andrejka for her question. So all of you, please join us via aquarimax.com or via Facebook, our Aquarimax page at Facebook, Twitter. We have an Aquarimax account on Twitter, and we also have an Aquarimax YouTube page.
Yes, so remember to let us know what you think of the new video.
Yes, and feel free to join us in any way you can. And hopefully...
enjoy your Valentine's Day.
Yeah. Have a good night, day, morning, whenever you happen to be listening to this. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.